Radio. What day is it? Oh, it's the 20. No, it's the 17th. Okay, dates have gone by, and I don't remember what day or time it is right now. Because we ran in this crazy lockdown, and sometimes I just don't remember what day and night is, and you know, that's very normal. And tonight, or today, we are interviewing Abigail Penste. She was the girl, the woman, that wrote this awesome book called The Goods, An All-American Town, A Predator Doctor, The Untold Story of the Genesis Who Brought Him Down. And if you have any questions, so, Abigail and me, you can always Twitter me at daytime 1976, call in at 347-850-8721, and I'm bringing on Bobby right now. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Carly.
So,
hey, Carly.
How
Hello?
Are you? Yeah,
I'm
you're
doing
on, buddy.
Fine. Yeah, I'm
doing
fine.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's
great.
Good.
Just
because
picked up on a lot of letters that I've been writing to all these stars about trying to get them on the shows that date back to April. So there was a lot of letters with recent shows. I had to rewrite them and just go P.S. as soon as possible because of the shows being inspired and stuff like that.
Exactly. And, our guest is here, Bobby. So I will put you on after the interview, and you can ask any questions that you might want to ask. So I will put you on hold.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. It's Daytime After Dark on Block Talk Radio. Today is our special guest. I've been wanting to interview her since the day her book came out because it's a must-read on your summer reading list, or so I say summer quarantine list. It's called The Goods, An All-American Town, A Predator Doctor, The Untold Story of the Dynastics Who Brought Him Down. And if you have any, if you want to call 1-347-850-8721, and here's Abigail.
Hello.
Hey, I am so honored and happy you agreed to do this. And I know we've been playing email tag for the last 3 months. It's okay, because it's been one of the most crazy times in Arlington ever with the stay-at-home order. I'm still
what
on stage one. I'm
oh my
on
goodness.
Stage
well,
one.
Carly, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for having me and for reading the book and for spreading the word about these amazing women in this book who bravely told their stories. I do appreciate your helping me spread the word, because they told their stories to help prevent future predators, and that's what we're doing today. So thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, I'm still on phase one of this lockdown in Seattle. I have no idea. I don't feel like there will be an end in sight for me. So I'm doing every interview I can to get my mind off being locked down. I mean, no mall, no anything. It's really, you know, kind of driving me crazy. So
I think it's going to go on for a long time. So, what better time? What better time to dig into some important books?
Exactly. And I read almost everyone's book on this case I can get my hands on. The Amazon guy must love me by now. I think I have this really weird thing with this case. But what really resonated with me in your book, how you told the story is all these girls, and no one listened to them. It was 30 years of, you know, no one was listening. Everyone covered it up. No one did anything. And for me, it's like, wait a moment. The one person you are supposed to trust, people, is the doctor of all people, you know, we are probably about the same age, and I mean, I'm 44, fine, I don't like that word anymore, but yes. But I, you know, growing up, we never, I mean, maybe your parents told you, but my parents never told me, oh, by the way, a doctor can be bad. You know, a doctor might be, you know, really bad. There was never this conversation had. And after I read your book and a couple more books on this, and seeing that some of the parents were in the room why Larry Nassar did the treatment, and, you know, he did this right in front of the parents, got them and trust them. Mm-hmm. And some of the girls thought, okay, maybe this is normal, because their whole life was a gym. They were not going out on a Friday night. They were not doing normal kids' activities. They were just, you know, having a gym gymnastics life, trying to go to the Olympics. Mm-hmm. So what my question is to you, when this all came out finally, and, you know, he finally had his day in court after watching it on YouTube. I just wanted to hit the guy, to be honest. I just wanted to hit the guy because I felt like his apology wasn't sincere. Mm. I felt sorry for all the girls that were involved in this case, and I felt like, you know, Michigan State, I think Michigan. You know, I believe they should have been held more accountable than they were, I believe the people in the ranch should have been held accountable long before this, because so a camp that doesn't allow your parents to even come and visit you.
Right.
I don't know. To me,
you touched on so many important points there. I mean, there's so much to unpack, I know. But yes, first of all, kids are taught to trust doctors. And Nasser started abusing kids back in the late 1980s, you know. So these were kids, gymnasts at a local gym in Michigan who, you know, they had been taught to trust their doctor. And he was an osteopath, so, you know, his focus was on manipulating bones and joints. And he would tell these kids, well, if I touch your one part of your body, it'll help another part of your body. And that's how he would sexually abuse them. So a lot of the kids didn't know they were being abused. He was the doctor, and he said he was treating them. And they were kids. And like you said, a lot of them grew up in this really abusive training environment where they were taught to fall in line and never to complain. And, you know, they were really physically, verbally, psychologically abused, you know, by the coaches. So that's the kind of vulnerable state they were in when they were sent to see Larry Nasser, the doctor. But the other really important thing that you zoomed in on, and which I think is such a powerful lesson that from these survivors, is that over the years, you know, Larry Nasser abused young women and girls for almost 30 years, and he kept rising through the ranks. He became, you know, he started as a volunteer doctor at a local gym in Michigan, and then he went on to become a professor and doctor at Michigan State University, and then he became the coach of the U.S. Olympic women's gymnastics team. So almost 30 years, all that time, he was abusing hundreds of young women and girls, and like I said, a lot of them didn't realize it because they were kids and they trusted their doctor, but some of them did realize it, and they did tell. They told coaches, they told counselors, they told the police, starting back in the 1990s. In fact, the very first known survivor said that her coach witnessed her abuse in the late 1980s. So,
exactly.
And so these girls who realized they were being abused and who did report him over the decades, they were just dismissed and disbelieved. No one listened to the girls. Everyone believed the doctor, including the police. You know, there was a teenage girl who reported him to the police in 2004 in Michigan, and the police interviewed her, and then they interviewed him, and they just believed him. He was a doctor. I mean, so decades of abuse could have been stopped if someone had listened to these young women. It's horrific.
Yeah, and what made you write this book? Because were you ever in gymnastics? Or were you in gymnastics book?
As a kid growing up in southern Indiana, I did take some gymnastics classes at the local girls' club, which I loved. I mean, it was such a far cry from the kind of abusive, hardcore training gyms, you know, that a lot of these women told me about. It was a girls' club. It was fun. You know, there was no pressure, and I loved it. And I understand as a kid why you want to keep going in that sport. It was just, you know, you want to do trickier and harder things, and you want to keep learning and growing and taking on, you know, bigger challenges. Like I remember when I did an aerial cartwheel, which was a cartwheel with no hands. I was so thrilled. So I understand that feeling of like you're a kid and you've got this cool sport and you want to excel and do better. And so I understood, you know, why these women were telling me these stories of how they got started in gymnastics and they just loved it. And that's what's so sad is a sport that's what it should be. You know, it should be fun, and kids should be encouraged. Instead, these kids were just brutalized by their coaches, by Larry Nasser, you know, by his enablers. But the reason I decided to write the book was that pretty soon after the Nasser scandal broke in 2016, I interviewed a young gymnast named Lindsay Lemke and her mom. And Lindsay was a gymnast at Michigan State University. And Nasser had been her doctor since she was a little kid. She grew up in gymnastics, and he'd been abusing her since she was a kid, but she thought he was treating her. And, you know, she and her mom, I remember they were still trying to wrap their heads around the whole thing because they trusted this man. They thought he was their family friend and their confidant. And to learn that he had been abusing Lindsay, you know, hundreds of times over the years. It was devastating. And I remember they said people were blaming them for it, you know, that they would, people they knew, acquaintances, friends on Facebook would say things like, wait, well, you know, people are clueless. Why didn't the girls tell? Why didn't the parents know? And I just thought, what a nightmare. This family is dealing with this unthinkable travesty, and people are blaming them for it. So I thought, let's help people understand how this happened and, you know, hopefully to help prevent it from happening again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I, you know, my niece, who's now 16, started in gymnastics, and this is way before Larry Nassar came on this. You know, we knew what he did, but they had scouts looking at her. She was that talented. She, oh my gosh, she was killing how many flips she did on the beam. She was the sick man. She was that good. But my brother and his wife basically asked, you know, looked at each other like, okay, do we want a kid or do we want to be doing this every weekend? And they had three other kids. And it was like, okay, those, you know, they just thought we cannot just give up her childhood, even though, you know, she's that good. I mean, she was good. And then when the whole Larry Nassar thing came out, and she asked me, she goes, she was like 14 or 13 at the time when it finally came out. And she goes, okay, I think I got the bullet, right? I go, yes, you did. You absolutely dodged the bullet. And that was the conversation I had with her. Like, you know, the doctors are not perfect. And doctors, some doctors are great. But some doctors can really do terrible things, and they have a way of covering this up. And, you know, with all the survivors that day, of the testimony and the judge, oh my gosh, I want to wrap my arms around the judge and say thank you, because she basically told me to sit down and he was going to hear, you know, three or 4 days of impact statements. And so a judge to do that was not the normal way. She didn't care. And she didn't know it was going to get hated on this. She just wanted the girls to be able to finally confront him and not be scared. And people don't realize some of these girls took their life. Some of, I mean, not all of them, but, you know, there were cases of suicide. And there were all cases of post-traumatic stress disorder now. And what really got to me is the fall of the Olympics were, I mean, were all around him, and they were all abused by him. And they couldn't wrap their, you know, head around it either. I mean, for a while, they were all in denial. Like, oh, no, he didn't do anything. They were all, but once they got back to in their brain, they were like, oh, no, yes, he did. And,
well, he used his power and his authority once he became the Olympic doctor. You know, and a lot of these gymnasts, they had just grown up being verbally, physically, psychologically abused. They were just, sadly, the perfect prey for a predator because, you know, they had been silenced. And so, and when he started abusing them, they were so young, they didn't realize it was abuse, most of them. And, you know, so that the environment they were in, and also they had, you know, they had been trained not to speak up, not to cause any trouble. So all these factors, all these forces combined, you know, it just created this terrible, perfect storm, you know, for a predator to abuse so many girls. And there were so many enablers, too, you know, like the very first known survivor who she told her story for the first time in this book. She was there from the very beginning when Nasser first walked into the door of this local gym in Michigan where he started volunteering as a doctor. And, you know, she says that her coach witnessed her abuse and did nothing. In fact, he mocked her body. He made fun of her, the size of her breasts, instead of instead of reporting the doctor. So he went on to become an Olympic coach. And, you know, she says if he had done something back in the late 80s, maybe hundreds of young women and girls would have been spared. And that was the theme, you know, throughout the reporting of this book, was that, oh, my goodness, there were so many missed opportunities to stop him.
Yeah, there were. I mean, there were so many missed opportunities with this case, and there were so many cries for help. There were those who were trying to get out of going to the session with him. And I'm sorry, but that's like full appearance. That would have been a red flag, like, okay, you love this coach, but you don't want to see him to make, you know, you better. Mm-hmm. But they had no idea this was going on. I mean, I do not blame the parents at all on this, because
they were victims too. Yeah.
Innocent as, you know, the goods that they got molested, and what the day of the testimony, what really the impact when the father, one of the fathers, I don't remember the name, but came up and nearly wanted to strangle him in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, go for it. Okay, you might not want to do it here in court, but I can see your anger. I can see your rage.
Of course. Parents were victimized too. Yeah, Nasser was a master manipulator. He manipulated the entire family. And it's like you said, he abused these girls while their parents were in the room. And that was the ultimate manipulation, because he knew that the kids would think, well, my mom or my dad is here, so everything must be okay. So even if the kids did have any doubts, well, their parents were there, so they thought, well, it must be okay. It must be a medical treatment. And, you know, meanwhile, the parents didn't know what he was doing, because he would block their view or he would cover up the child with a towel. So the parents didn't know what he was doing. And when I spoke to some of those parents, and when they found out, you know, what he had been doing to their children while they were in the room, they were devastated. All these families are dealing with such fallout now. And you raised the important point, too, about PTSD. And I think a lot of people don't realize that they think Nasser's in jail, story's over. The story, it has only just begun for the survivors of his abuse, because they are dealing with the emotional trauma, you know, a lifetime of fallout from being betrayed. You know, some of these women who were abused as kids and didn't realize it, they didn't know, or they buried the memories until some of the women stood up in court. That's when some other women realized, oh, my God, it happened to me too. So they're, you know, adults in their 30s, 40s. Some of them have children of their own. And they're now having to wrestle with the fact that this trusted figure from their childhood betrayed them in the most profound way. And so, you know, they're dealing with all this trauma now, you know, as adults, realizing what happened to them as children. So it's an ongoing journey. But I will say this, all these women, you know, I spoke to 25 women for the book across the decades, spanning almost three decades from the very first survivor to the very last, and they all told me, they told their stories because they wanted to help other families recognize the signs of a predator and to empower other survivors to speak out, because they felt like they could use their terrible experience to help other people. And I think that is so powerful. You know, I just felt like they were grabbing the power back from this predator and sharing the power with other people and helping to prevent this kind of abuse in the future. And that is just, that is an incredible, phenomenal thing, you know, to witness. And I'm just so in awe of these survivors, because it takes guts to tell a story like this. If you go public, if you publicly identify yourself as a survivor of abuse, well, you know, everyone knows something about you, something very personal about you. before they even meet you. Like if you go on a job interview or on a first date, well, you know, your employer might Google you, you know, your date might Google you. They know something deeply personal about you before you even see them for the first time. And that takes courage, you know, to put yourself out there like that. And they all did so to help other people. So that is something really beautiful that came from this terrible situation.
Exactly. And the question I have for you, so after the case was done and over, and, you know, they gave him, like, I don't know, 300 years of, you know, a couple of life sentences for what he did, you know, I mean, I was hoping the death penalty and that would have been the case for it, but I could see why the girls wanted him to just sit in the jail cell and think about what he did for the rest of their life. But it made me think, wait a moment, you're a big target now on your back going to jail. And to be honest, I'm surprised we haven't heard someone took him out in jail, to be honest, after reading book by book. And unless they haven't been solitary and not in the public part of the jail, I was just really, you know, thinking, okay, this is going to be really interesting playing out. And did they cover, I mean, they should be covering, did they cover for all the girls for mental health and counseling after everything they've been through? Did someone step up and do that for the victim? Did they set
it up? Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, number one, Nassar will be in jail for the rest of his life because he had, well, he was sentenced twice in Michigan for on sexual abuse charges, and then in federal court for possessing tens of thousands of images of child pornography. So he's serving out three sentences, and he will be in jail for the rest of his life. But it's but yes, that's a very good point too about what's being done for the survivors. And you know, the answer is not enough. They did get a settlement from Michigan State University, and that will help with, yeah, they have bills for, they have medical bills, yeah, because these, you know, a lot of them are suffering from lifelong injuries that were not treated when they were kids because Nassar was not a real doctor. So there's that, and then there's the therapy, the therapy sessions they need. This all costs money, and so there's some money from the Michigan State settlement, but, you know, there are some 500 women who have come forward now. And there are probably many more, you know. So it's not enough. And there's the USA Gymnastics offered a settlement, which the, you know, the women told me was just insulting. And really what they, for them, you know, it's really about justice, accountability, and change. But yes, they need money for their medical bills, for their therapy bills, but they also want to see change, you know, in the sport. I mean, Nassar,
exactly,
you know, he got his hands, he's known for abusing gymnasts and Olympic gymnasts and gymnasts across the community in Michigan, but he also got his hands on dancers, on volleyball players, runners, cheerleaders, because at Michigan State he worked at a sports medicine clinic where he got his hands on kids from across the community. So he got his hands on so many people, and, you know, they're all now suffering from this emotional fallout and trauma. But they want to see his enablers brought to justice, too. He's in jail. Okay, that's a start. But there are many people around him who enabled this abuse for decades. One of them is the coach who he worked with for almost 30 years in Michigan, John Gettard. He became an Olympic coach alongside Nassar as Olympic doctor. And so many of the women told me that this coach was verbally, physically, psychologically abusive, and, you know, that he witnessed the abuse. One, as I said, the first known survivor said this coach witnessed her abuse and did nothing. And he's been under investigation for a couple of years now by police in Michigan, but You know, these so many women told me they want to see him brought to justice, and so many others, because, you know, Nassar, over the decades, had a lot of people, you know, he was a master manipulator of everyone around him, but a lot of people also just did not pay attention or outright enabled the abuse. I mean, you know, at Gettert's gym, Nassar abused girls for almost 30 years in the back room of that gym, you know. So these women really want to see accountability and change, too.
Well, exactly. And I know this was supposed to be a 20-minute interview. I know.
Sorry.
But you know what? I mean, if you come back, I mean, God, I think we need to do a whole almost because your book just resonated everything in me because I'm like thinking, okay, specifically the one girl that had to go through the spine surgery and all of that. And I'm like, you know, I just, what I heard about that and everything she went through, it was like, oh my God, she just went through the abuse and not only the abuse, but then she had to have spine surgery, and that's so painful and everything. So, yeah, and I commend you for writing this book. And you have kids, right? You have a little girl, right?
No, I don't have kids. But I think that story that you mentioned, that was, I think, was that Sarah Turisti, the first known survivor, and she broke her sternum. Is that the one you're thinking of?
I think, yeah. And
yeah, that,
I mean,
that was incredible. Like, I mean, her story, I think, is so very powerful and just groundbreaking in helping people understand all of this because she, you know, she told me this story for the book that it says so much. She, about the culture of the sport and what it does to children to have an abusive coach drilling these ideas into your head as a kid. You know, the gymnasts were told not to say if they were injured because injuries were their fault because they weren't concentrating. So when she got injured falling off a balance beam, she broke her sternum and she blamed herself. She thought there was an instant in the air when she could have adjusted herself to land better, but she didn't because she thought she'd be landing in a pit of foam blocks. And she was tired, she was hot, she was malnourished, she was a kid, she was being brutalized by her coach. In that split second, she didn't adjust her body to try to land better, and she broke her sternum, and she had to, you know, just excruciating surgeries and pain after. And then her coach was mad at her because she was injured, and then she got sent into Larry Nassar's lair, you know. So what she told me is that decades later, she's in her 40s now with kids of her own, and she still blames herself for getting injured. Like that, to me, it says so much about, you know, what it does to kids to have that kind of abusive coaching drilled into their heads from the time they're so young. She's, you know, she's working through it. She's talking to a therapist. She's trying to rewire her thinking. You know, I said to her, if someone told you this story, if someone told you they blame themselves for this, you know, this thing that happened in their childhood, you would tell them, that's not your fault. And she said, I know, but she said, I can't see it for myself. So, you know, I think that is a really powerful example of how, you know, how important it is to, there's so many lessons for families in this to, you know, and for athletes to be aware of these things.
Yeah,
like, who are we trusting?
I call it the lessons for all the parents and all the upcoming gymnasts who, you know, want to do this. And, you know, when I heard more and more about the rants, they were sending these girls to year after year, and the parents were not allowed to go. And, you know, I'm so close to my niece that if she were in a camp like that for like a month or two, and they would say, no, you cannot go there. Then I'm like, wait, there's something going on down there that they don't want you to know. And I
Yeah, that's a real red flag. The Caroli Ranch, right, they would they wouldn't let parents. This was the Caroli Ranch in Texas, which was the elite gymnast training center, the Olympic gymnast training center. And, yeah, I spoke to some of the gymnasts who had gone there. And one of them was an Olympian, you know, who described that kind of the same kind of outright abusive training, and how, yeah, parents weren't allowed there. You know, these little kids would get sent there. Parents weren't allowed. It was like a ranch, you know, isolated, and Master had free reign with these girls there. You know, he would go into their rooms, their cabins, and no one was supervising, you know. But, yeah, a major red flag is the parents were not allowed into the Caroli Ranch to see what was going on with their kids. Now the ranch has since been shut down, but you're right, that in itself is terrifying. You know, one of the young women from Michigan, she was a teenager, she was on the Olympic track, and she was sent to the Caroli Ranch, and she was so young, you know, she said her mom would go with her to Texas and would stay in the closest hotel she could, and they would be on the phone at night. You know, the young woman's name was Autumn, and she'd be on the phone at night with her mom, and her mom would talk to her as she went to sleep, because it was scary. You know, she was a kid.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
I mean,
boot camp.
And like I said, I would love to have you on again, because there's so much I feel like we cannot cover in the limited time, because I mean, like I've read so much on this case, and you know, I think that, you know, I'm so glad that, you know, the gymnast finally spoke up. And, you know, since we are not having the Olympics this year, and who knows if there will be in 21, you know, they've already canceled the Oscars. So I don't know if the Olympics will even go on next year.
Who knows? I know. Who knows?
Yeah, because of, and I think about all the goods that are working their butt off right now for the Olympics, and then they go, oh, well, we cannot do anything right now because we are in lockdown. And I just pray that, you know, they do a better job with these goods now that everything out in the open. And, you know, really, I wish, like, the FBI would took a notice long before this happened, because, you know, I think the FBI should have, you know, it should have been on their radar, you know, after complaints.
They failed, too.
And,
all the major
institutions
failed.
Before you go, my co-host, Bobby, Bobby, did you have any questions?
Yeah, I just want to say, first of all, how are you doing today, Abigail?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. I so appreciate your having me on the show, and, you know, and like I said, spreading the word about these brave women who shared their stories. They did so because they thought they could help other people, and you're helping them do just that, so I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Now, other than the report that I've heard that was reported on ESPN and broadcast on SportsCenter and Outside the Lines last year when it first came out, what had we learned from that you haven't covered, basically just from what ESPN and GMA and all those other news shows did when this came out, as far as what happened with the Michigan State doctor? And my second question is, was Gabby Douglas part of this scandal? Because I know, because I think I read somewhere she was, and then I'm forgetting if she was or not, because this could have been more evidence for her to just go by for her biopic that came out a couple of years ago after she won the gold.
In answer to your question about what did I learn beyond what had been reported, I learned so much. If you read the book, there's just so much groundbreaking, news-breaking insight from the women in the book, because, you know, I spoke to 25 survivors spanning almost three decades, from the very first known survivor to the very last. And they show over the years how this predator emerged, and the first known survivor, she told her story for the first time in this book, and, you know, she just shed such important light on how Nassar got his start, how he and the coach Gettert, you know, became friends and colleagues for decades and rose to the top of the sport as Olympic doctor and coach. And, you know, she and so many others, you know, said Gettert was this key enabler. But that's just one of many examples of the insights in this book. Another woman who told her story for the first time described how Gettert, she said, he initiated a sexual relationship with her when she was a teen. Now, she said he groomed her for a couple of years, starting when she was 15 or 16, and when she left the gym at 18 for college, he initiated a sexual relationship. So she was of legal age, but he had been her coach and her mentor. She trusted him. She had been taught to obey him, and that kind of relationship goes against the rules of safe sport, you know, the Olympic watchdog. So she told her story because she wanted families to understand, hey, you know, this, there's all kinds of grooming that goes on, you know, in these sports. And if you have young, impressionable teenage girls who are taught to trust and obey their coach, this is what happened to her. She thought he loved her. She thought he was going to marry her. She says he discarded her, and it just left her devastated, and it had lifelong effects on her relationships, on trust issues, you know. So there's a lot of insight in this book that has never been reported elsewhere, and it's because a lot of these women had never told their stories before. They, you know, they felt like the media really focuses on the famous gymnast, the Olympic gymnast, and, you know, that people don't realize that there were hundreds of others who were preyed upon by this guy. So if you read the book, you really get a sense of, you know, what kinds of new insight these women brought to light.
Right. And was Gabby Douglas one of the victims? Because I don't remember if I recall if she was or not.
I believe she has said that she was. She did. But, you know, my book really focused on the people who, you know, the unknown stories, the unheard stories, the stories that hadn't been told. And so I wasn't focusing so much on the Olympic gymnast. But, yes, she has said that she was abused by him.
Right.
Thanks
for answering my question. And you're welcome back anytime to talk a little bit more in depth about it.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, and I just want to point out, I saw that some people may get in this morning. There's a new documentary series called Athlete A on June 24th on Netflix. So were you any part of that?
No, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing it because it focuses on Maggie Nichols, the gymnast who told, you know, who alerted USA Gymnastics about Nassar's abuse back in 2015. And then, of course, USA Gymnastics profoundly failed and, you know, basically did nothing. They suspended Nassar, but they lied to the gymnast about why he was no longer working. And then they didn't tell the FBI for weeks, and the FBI didn't do anything. And they didn't tell Michigan State, where Nassar continued to abuse girls, and they didn't tell the Twist Stars, the gym in Michigan, where he continued to abuse girls. So, you know, setting up, you know, her story really highlights the profound failures among these institutions. It wasn't until the Indianapolis Star newspaper reported the allegations more than a year later that things started to happen. So, yes, I'm very much looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, and I just want everyone to know it comes on Netflix June 24th, and I'm sure right now if you go to Netflix, you can put it on your list now, I hope, because I really want to watch it. When I saw that on People Magazine, I'm like, okay, I'm interviewing Abigail today, and then this comes out. I'm like, okay, that's a coincidence.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and
this
so
is
said, thank
definitely
you.
This story is an ongoing story. Well, thank you so much for having
yeah,
me.
Yeah, and
really
please
it.
Come back. I mean, there's so much we can cover, and after the documentary comes out, I would love to have you back so we
aww.
Both can have our opinion on it, because I'm thankful that they are doing a documentary series on this. So, yeah, so thank you so much for coming on, and we hope you can come back.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Carly. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah.
And have a great
you
day.
Have a good day.
Thank
have
you.
A good day.
You too.
Take
care.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, Bobby, how did I do?
You did good. And I was going to say, thank you for the comment that you made before the show on Facebook for me.
Well, I just feel like, you know, I said on the last show that, you know, I felt like these girls haven't been heard. You know, they were, they were heard, but they were not, you know, no one believed them for so long. And this is why people don't report things like this, because of this case. Because, you know, I really believe that they, you know, they did this. And, you know, there was never a moment that, you know, I mean, if I had a dollar, I don't think I could really in good conscience, you know, let my dollar be in the domestic room, Bobby. I just don't think that could happen because of
mm-hmm.
all the things I read and everything, and you know, yeah, but I'm so glad that you came on tonight
yeah.
and you were with me on this interview.
Yeah.
Maggie is feeling sick.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, she might have the flu.
I hope
but
yeah. But going back to this thing, looking at what these gymnast ladies have been through, it reminded me of what, and I guess I can say his name, but I'm sure you don't want to hear him, what President Trump went through when all these ladies that came out before he got elected had admitted to what they said and said it on national television in different interviews. But what's different?
Exactly my point. And, you know, I just think that, you know, I mean, even though we are a daytime program, you know, daytime after dark, I feel the need that at time to time we are going to cover stories like this, because I just feel like we have this platform. And you know, we need to use it for good and not bad. And so we have this platform, and I think right now we just need to use it. And
you know, 1 second, I got a call. You can talk among yourself for a second.
Okay.
Hello? Yeah. Hello, Carly? Carly? Hello?
Yeah,
Carly?
I'm here, buddy.
I'm sorry about that. I had to take a call with my mom, but I can still talk.
Well, I was going to say, because, you know, we have The call's tonight, tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we are having it so Friday because of the guests.
Right.
You know, lined up, backed out or whatever. So I will let you know, of course, what is happening.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Hi.
So, have a great day, everyone. Take a little time and enjoy the view. And remember, people,
wash your hands and wear a mask and social distancing and all that good stuff. I know. Well, you have a good day yourself, Carly, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. And don't forget to watch General Hospital later on today and Carson Week.
Like I said, tomorrow night is our Carson night.
I'm almost done. Give me 30 seconds.
Yeah, and it will be at 5 p.m. my time, 8 U time, right?
8 p.m. David and mine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, have a great day, Bobby.
All right. Have a good one, Carly.
Okay. Bye. So, you guys, that's it for today. But I wanted to wish my mom a very happy birthday from yesterday. Mom, you rock. And I just want to close out the show dedicating a song to my mom, the Taylor Swift song, Best Day. So in a moment I will play it. And then that's how we are going to close the show.
Today.
In, and I hope you listen to the show when you have a chance, and have a good night. Bye-bye. Oh, and we will be back on tomorrow night with Carlson Knight. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.